Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Here we are, not much more than a week into Trump 2, and already my head is spinning. The necessitous two segments today, both gazing into the crystal ball to divine what the second coming of our would-be dictator is going to look like. Anatole Lieven will try to predict a Trump foreign policy out of his untrustworthy rhetoric and early appointments, and Alex Vitale will meditate on what he means for crime and punishment. The first few cabinet appointments have ranged from the scarily conventional to the outlandish. Some friends are finding comedy in the nominations. I understand that point of view, but I and most of the people I know and love have to live here. Most extravagant of all was the nomination of Matt Gaetz as Attorney General, hated by those who know him best, his congressional colleagues, but beloved by Trump. Mark Caputo of The Bulwark got a Trump insider, as the tabloids call them, to share some thoughts on the nomination. Quote, "None of the attorneys had what Trump wants, and they don't talk like Gaetz. Everyone else looked at the AG as if they were applying for some judicial appointment. They talked about their vaunted legal theories and constitutional bull. Gaetz was the only one who said, 'Yeah, I'll go over there and start cutting effing heads,' edited to keep the FCC off our back." Here with some analysis of what Trump's foreign policy might look like is a frequent Behind the News guest, Anatole Lieven, Eurasia Director at the Quincy Institute. This interview was recorded on Tuesday, before the outlandish Wednesday nominations. I asked him for an update, and here's what he said. Trump's foreign policy appointments are, predictably, very disappointing. None of them is remotely qualified for the job they have been given. This team promises slavish obedience to Israel and bitter hostility to China. It may perhaps genuinely aim at peace in Ukraine, but there are good reasons to question whether it is competent and coherent enough to achieve this. Anatole Lieven. Trump said the other day, no Pompeo, no Haley. That signals something. There are divisions within the Republican Party, neocons versus what are usually characterized as isolationists or America firsters. So what's your impression of the Trump appointments so far, and how do they comport with the divisions within the Republican Party?
He's rejected the outright neocons, Pompeo and Haley, but he certainly hasn't gone with people on Vance's side as yet. At least, last time I looked, it wasn't certain that he would appoint Rubio. But, I mean, if he does, then that is mostly a sign of continuity.
I saw a bunch of right-wingers, like, trying to convince themselves that the Rubio report was premature and not confirmed yet. Why is he such a flashpoint?
Well, I think simply because Rubio is regarded as somebody who has always tried to, on foreign policy, go with, I mean, if you like, the mainstream hawks, not the kind of neocon ideologues, but, you know, he's taken a very hawkish line on Venezuela, on Cuba, well, he has a particular background there, of course, but on Iran, he's never come out in front, shall we say, when it comes to peace with Russia, and well, on China, of course, he's going with the mainstream. So I think that the feeling is that Trump is not going to be nearly as much of a difference as some people hoped. But, of course, the thing about Trump is that whereas on domestic policy, unfortunately, he has, you know, huge numbers of Republican right-wingers at every level, national, state, local, who implement his policies. In foreign policy, he doesn't. The field is very, very, very thin. So he ends up either choosing complete outliers like Flynn the last time, or people who will basically continue existing policies. I mean, the other thing, of course, is, I mean, not that that's unusual in democracies, but, you know, Rubio has no background in international diplomacy at all. You can't help thinking that if, you know, if Rubio goes into a room with Sergei Lavrov, Lavrov will eat him alive. He will not have the grasp of what he's talking about. I mean, that's why one hopes and one doesn't hope that he will rely on the professional diplomats, because on the other hand, the professional diplomats very likely would want to sabotage the entire Trump agenda. So it's not looking good.
What happened to the idea of Trump? This circulated in some precincts that Trump was the peace candidate.
Well, I mean, the point is that the Democrats laid themselves absolutely open to that. It is, of course, a ridiculous idea, except possibly to a limited extent with Russia, but nowhere else. I mean, starting on in the Middle East. But of course, if the Democrats not merely portray themselves as hawks, but try to out-hawk Trump, you know, accuse Trump of weakness and cowardice, well, you know, you could say they deserve what they get.
Yes, really. Now, there's an article in Haaretz the other day that placed a lot of weight on Tucker Carlson's characterization of Pompeo as a really sinister person and a criminal for plotting to kill Julian Assange. Is there anything to this? Does Tucker Carlson have some kind of influence over U.S. foreign policy now?
Well, I think he may have some influence over Trump, simply because Trump is aware of Tucker Carlson's influence and popularity. And, of course, on Russia, they may well have certain affinities. I mean, I can't speak to Pompeo as planning that particular murder, though, of course, Pompeo has, without going into detail, spoken openly in his time at the CIA of planting fake information, killing people.
Oh, yeah, he thought that was big fun. He was laughing about it.
Exactly, yeah, it was a real joke. You know, it's weird, Doug, because I was at an academic mini-conference symposium the other day, and one of the participants was going all the way back in Russian history to the early 19th century and talking about old Russian innate traditions of disinformation, you know, and fake bomb attacks and all this bribing politicians. And I asked her whether the Russian intelligence and the CIA had had any process of mutual learning from this point of view. And of course, she didn't even understand what I was talking about. But I thought my point was rather clear, actually.
Things aren't looking very bright for Ukraine, at least compared to the blank check that the Biden administration had offered. What do you think is going to happen with aid to Ukraine? I saw, who was it, Waltz, the putative national security advisor, is asking the Europeans to contribute more. But what do you think is going to come with Ukraine?
For the moment, Biden has stitched up aid to Ukraine for some time to come, of course. And yes, I mean, undoubtedly, there will be tremendous U.S. pressure on the Europeans to increase their aid. The question is what Trump will actually do and what Rubio will do as Secretary of State actually to try to reach a peace agreement in Ukraine. And there, various ideas have been floated, but some of them would simply not fly with the Russians. The Russians would not negotiate on that basis. So if you're going to have a peace process, negotiations that stand any chance of success, there's got to be some really careful preparation, and not by Trump and not by Rubio, you know, by professional diplomats talking strictly in private, ideally in secret with the Russians, to find out just what Russia is prepared to negotiate and compromise on and what it's not, and whether, in fact, the Trump administration is then prepared to negotiate on that basis. Because the big fear, I think, and it's a fear that the Russians themselves have told me that they really share, is that there'll be a replay of what Trump tried with North Korea during his first term, that he will plunge in himself, unprepared, with no idea of who and what he's really dealing with, and that possibly, you know, the US establishment will set him up to fail, the State Department, and that when Putin rejects his unviable plan, you know, Trump will then lose his temper and start abusing Putin and Russia and go back to unconditional support for Ukraine, and we'll be worse off than we were when we started. So it's also a question of whether the new Trump administration will actually be capable of careful, sensible, traditional diplomacy. And we just don't know. There are, of course, reasons to worry that it won't.
Say what you will about Putin, he's no lightweight. It seems like Trump is just no match for him.
Well, I'm afraid that's true. I mean, on the other hand, of course, in the end, it will come down to, you know, not personalities, but irreducible realities on the battlefield. Presumably, it will also depend on what advice Putin is getting about the chances of much, much faster Russian advances. And similarly, I mean, Trump. If Trump is told, you know, with this level of aid, we can, or increased European aid, we can hold the Russians for a considerable time, then that will have one impact on him. If he's told that the Ukrainians are in danger of early collapse, well, then I would very much doubt that Trump would want to greatly increase US aid to Ukraine, that would go against everything he's been saying so far, and certainly everything that Vance has been saying. So that might incline Trump to try for an early peace settlement. We'll have to see.
As we were speaking, a bulletin just popped up on my screen that Trump is intending to nominate Mike Huckabee as ambassador to Israel. That's quite an appointment.
Well, and Stefanik.
Yeah. What do you make of her at the UN? Does she have any foreign policy experience? Which is she capable of dealing with over 100 other members of the UN?
Oh, I think she's as capable as John Bolton was.
Is that praise or not?
No, it most certainly is not. I mean, but the role of the American ambassador to the UN for a very long time now has been not to persuade other countries, but to shout at them for, you know, domestic US audiences. I'm sure Stefanik will be very good at that.
And what about this Mike Waltz, nominated as National Security Advisor? Do you know anything about him?
Not a lot, except that he seems to be, no doubt because of his own service in Afghanistan, obsessed with the war on terror. And, you know, he has gone on the record as saying that, you know, America should have stayed in Afghanistan or even should now go back into Afghanistan, which seems wildly out of key with anything that Trump believes. Part of the problem is that these people are all amateurs. I mean, I'm sure that Waltz isn't an amateur soldier. I'm sure he's a good soldier. But, you know, when it comes to understanding anything about other countries, their governments, their interests, their attitudes, I see no evidence that any of these people either have that or indeed are interested in developing it.
Well, toughness is what it's all about, right?
Well, yeah, but that's fine if you are, in fact, tougher than the other guy. You know, there is an unkind phrase, I believe, semi-tough, not a term of praise, I believe. Yeah, sure, that it comes down to the end, you know, in the end. Is America tougher than Russia in Ukraine? Is America prepared to be tougher than China over Taiwan? Well, I mean, I'm not saying that they should be, because then we'd probably head straight for war. But I mean, you know, I mean, in ordinary human life, it's a great, great mistake to pretend to be tougher than you actually are.
I'm speaking with Anatole Levin of the Quincy Institute. Now, how did Trump's proposed tariffs, whether they actually come to pass or not is another story, but how would they fit into foreign relations?
Well, the Chinese are, of course, very worried. If Trump actually slaps 100% tariffs on Chinese goods across the board, some analysis says that Chinese GDP growth will drop to virtually zero. On the other hand, of course, that could have a devastating effect on the world economy and send inflation in America through the roof. So we don't know whether Trump will actually do that. I mean, the other people who are really worried are, of course, the Europeans. And, you know, I think one of the risks is that to save themselves from the imposition of really high tariffs on European goods, the Europeans may, well, they may well play along with Trump when it comes to higher aid to Ukraine and higher military spending, but they may also feel compelled to take a much tougher line against China. And of course, if Chinese European trade collapses, well, that will also have a very bad effect on the world economy.
China does seem to be the target of both parties, really. What are they aiming for? Containing China at this point seems out of the question. That ship has sailed. Do they have any sense of what their end game is?
Yes, they do. They think, it seems somehow, that if you can keep this up for decades, the Chinese communist state will collapse the way that the Soviet state collapsed, which misses so many differences between the two that, you know, I mean, don't get me started. But that does seem to be the basic hawkish idea. I mean, short of that, there is the hope, you know, if not to cripple the Chinese economy as a whole, certainly to cripple its high-tech economy in a way that will really hold back Chinese military competition with the United States. But the problem there, of course, is that if God forbid it comes to war, and stop short of nuclear war, at which point, as you might say, everything we're talking about will be academic. It's not that in any case the Chinese, for decades to come, would be able to defeat the US Navy in the Eastern Pacific or the Indian Ocean or the Atlantic, because with its aircraft carriers and its, huge fleet of destroyers and submarines, it's, US can go on dominating there. And, China is lagging seriously behind in some of these things. But from China's point of view, I don't think the Chinese have the slightest desire to challenge America in those areas. Where China is aiming to dominate is basically in its own littoral waters. And there, I think US planners are looking at this, but they need to look at it much more closely and draw the political and diplomatic consequences from it. Look what happened to the Russian Black Sea Fleet. Before the Russian invasion of Ukraine, every military analyst I know, and certainly the Russians themselves, believed that the Black Sea Fleet would simply dominate the Black Sea, because the Ukrainians have essentially no navy at all. What's happened? Well, in fact, simply with the use of land-based drones and missiles, the Ukrainians have crippled the Black Sea Fleet and driven it from its base at Sevastopol. Well, now, that says something about what happens to large, sophisticated warships when they get too close to somebody else's coast, if that somebody else is amply equipped with drones and missiles. And of course, the Chinese, they may not be able, capable of producing very many nuclear aircraft carriers, but they can produce an almost literally unlimited number of drones. And now the conclusion to be drawn from that is, look, if the present general situation is in America's favor in the Far East, and basically can only get worse, that should be an argument, for God's sake, to try to freeze the existing situation, to keep out of trouble, to not exacerbate it and provoke the Chinese. But almost nobody in Washington is saying this. I mean, I hope they're saying it in the US Navy, but if so, it's not coming out in public. And also, of course, they may well not be, because of this ghastly nexus, between the Navy and the Air Force, and the Army to a considerable extent, and the military-industrial complex, which we see now also in terms of supplies to Ukraine. Of course, they all, for their different reasons, love building shiny, extremely sophisticated, extremely expensive and profitable platforms, like aircraft carriers and destroyers and warplanes, and not building lots and lots and lots of drones, or, for example, making lots and lots and lots of 155mm artillery shells, because they aren't shiny and prestigious, and, of course, as far as the military-industrial complex is concerned, the profits are much smaller. So, this wonderful American system has ended up really, really badly supplying the American armed forces for the actual threats they face, while at the same time the American foreign security establishment has, you might almost say, done its utmost to increase those threats.
Okay, now NATO. Before we discuss whether Trump will pull out of it, what purpose does NATO serve these days?
Well, as Orwell said about Britain in 1984, part of it is Airstrip 1. That's what he called Britain. In other words, it is a base, an air base, a naval base, to some extent a political base, a logistics base, from which America can project power across North Africa, West Asia, Eurasia. Now, of course, America could do that by bilateral agreements without NATO, but that would be politically more difficult because, at least from the point of view of European governments, because if you can say that this is all part of collective security and defense of the free world, then it's much easier to get your populations to accept US military bases than if you say, this is just Germany making a deal with America because we don't want to look after our own security, and therefore we're willing basically to become American client states. So NATO is quite an important political cover from that point of view. As far as European security is concerned, I think to a very considerable extent, NATO exists to, as has been said by people before me, NATO exists in order to increase the threats to Europe, which it then offers to defend Europe against. Really, I mean, with Russia, that's it. And oh, by the way, I mean, in the Middle East as well, you know, one of the biggest threats for many years now to Europe, in terms both of, I mean, obviously just killing European citizens, but also really dividing and undermining European liberal democracies, has of course been the threat of terrorism from right-wing nativists as well as Islamists. Well, the way in which the American alliance and fear of Russia has, you know, contributed to this slavish subservience to insane US agendas in the Middle East, you know, is really not to be underestimated, and thereby, you know, increase the threat of terrorism and civil strife in Europe.
Okay, so is there any chance he will actually pull out of NATO? And no. If that happens, what would the result be?
No, he's not going to pull out of NATO. It's much too useful. There are so many things Trump has said. He'll bluster and threaten in order to get the Europeans to pay more. But there's no chance of him actually pulling out. I think none whatsoever. You know, a much bigger risk, I think, is that he will completely fumble a diplomatic process with Russia, and that this will lead to, you know, a dangerous cycle of escalation in which, well, in the first term, you know, he blustered and blustered, but always in the end pulled away from the brink with various countries. So hopefully he'll do that again.
And finally, taking a long view, coming out of World War II, there was this cast of waspy imperial planners, socially coherent group for the most part, with a long-term vision of what they wanted to do, and they mostly succeeded at it. We have neither a coherent formation of policymakers in the social sense or a coherent set of ambitions. Where does this leave us? Is this just another symptom of American imperial decline?
The problem is that you see clear signs of imperial decline. You could say that, you know, Trump, in terms of the American establishment, is something like, you know, a Goth or a Vandal in the Roman service circa 450 AD. That's perhaps being a little unkind, but you get the general idea. But on the other hand, the US establishment is still absolutely wedded in the end. At least the great part of it, to the Wolfowitz doctrine of American hegemony, not just in the world as a whole, but in every part of the world. And, you know, there's tremendous resistance to pulling back and compromising anywhere, with Russia, with Iran, with China. And in the meantime, of course, this also means the total neglect of America's backyard in Central America, even, of course, as half the political scene screams hysterically about immigration and drugs. This can be seen in purely military terms as well. You know, I alluded to the problems of the US Navy. But if you look at something, you know, absolutely critical in the case of Ukraine, and where they are failing extremely badly, air defense systems and missiles, America simply does not have enough and cannot make enough quickly enough, both to supply Ukraine and to defend Israel and to keep enough in stock for a potential war with China. So there just aren't enough of them to go around. Now, you know, you talked about a sensible and coherent strategy would be, obviously, to try to solve at least one of these rivalries, but Obama tried to do that with Iran against the opposition of a great part of the American establishment, and Trump wrecked it. Trump may try to do it with Russia against the opposition of a large part of the American establishment, and we have to see if he can pull it off.
That was Anatole Levin, director of the Eurasia Program at the Quincy Institute. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break. Listen to the second movement of Felix Mendelssohn's String Quartet No. 1, performed by the Emerson Quartet. It's a bit of a chestnut, but lovely nonetheless. Mendelssohn wrote the work when he was 20. Next, Trump and the Cops. Trump loves cops, and cops love him, and that could be very bad news for many of us. While policing is mostly a local affair in the U.S., the federal government does have some leverage over it formally, and Trump's cheerleading may encourage the cops to beat heads even harder and more frequently than they do. And then there are the deportations. What might those look like, and how could they be resisted? Here are some answers to these questions is Alex Vitale, professor of sociology and coordinator of the Policing and Social Justice Project at Brooklyn College and the CUNY Graduate Center. His book, The End of Policing, a bit of an ambiguous title, was published by Verso in 2017. Alex Vitale. Pundits are saying that Trump's election was a reaction to an alleged crime wave and Dems' soft-on-crime policies. Let's talk a bit about the trajectory of crime rates. There was an uptick in 2020, 2021. It looks like it's receded since, but give us a detail and some historical perspective on this.
The overall trend on crime has been down since the late 80s and early 90s, and violent crime rates in a huge amount of the country are at historic lows. But during the pandemic, there was an uptick in some categories of crime, including some of the most serious categories like homicide. There was also the kind of the moral panic around retail crime. But over the last year or two, those numbers have come down significantly. And homicide numbers in particular are down quite a bit. And we have really enjoyed a public safety dividend in many ways over the last 25, 30 years.
What about that retail thing? People are making a lot out of having to find a clerk to unlock the shampoo. What's been going on with that?
So there was basically an organized effort to encourage very vulnerable people to steal retail items that would then be resold on the internet. So this wasn't stealing for personal use typically. The stuff was being fenced, you know, at very low rates by people who were then getting rich reselling the stuff. And of course, part of what this whole operation relied on was a huge pool of extremely poor people who were willing to take the risks of shoplifting for very minor financial gain. I think another aspect of this, though, is the way in which retail establishments have enhanced their own risk by cutting employees, by putting in self-checkout machines. So in their bid for cost-cutting, they basically opened the door to making this kind of retail theft much easier. And then finally, there was a certain degree of hyperbole where companies were saying that their own poor performance was actually the result of retail theft. And a number of companies have had to dial back those claims and said that actually the poor performance was the result of bad business decision making.
Now, there's been a war on progressive prosecutors. Some of them lost, not all of them lost in the most recent round of elections. What about that? How much effect do they have, and are they a disappearing breed?
Well, they're not a disappearing breed. We still have several, and some of them are very popular and have won re-election, like Larry Krasner in Philadelphia. I always have felt that there are profound limits to the progressive prosecutor movement, which was largely driven by folks in the defense bar, you know, lawyers trying to remake the legal system and thinking that that would be sufficient to dial back mass criminalization. And I think what that movement lacked was a strong basis in communities that experience high levels of crime and disorder relative to other areas, and that just pursuing a strategy of like reduced incarceration doesn't address the profound insecurities that a lot of these communities experience. And this made that whole movement really vulnerable to backlash, because the infrastructure of public safety in the communities was not enhanced by this movement, with some exceptions, including Krasner, who's gone out and raised millions of dollars to put into actual communities to make communities safer. And of course, he has enjoyed, as a result, the highest level of kind of electoral support.
What kind of programs do you have in mind there?
So like community-based violence reduction efforts that work with communities to hire people from the community to work with young people most at risk of engaging in violence, the so-called credible messenger kind of model. But it could also include community justice centers that do mediations, that provide family supports. There's a lot of options out there.
Now, how much defunding of the police really went on? The Republicans made a big deal out of it. Even some conservative Democrats are saying we just should drop that phrase completely. Did it really happen?
It didn't really happen. I mean, there were a couple of cities that some stuff happened on the margins, like Newark, New Jersey, where the results actually were extremely positive, and the mayor there is so popular that he's running for governor. But largely, this was rhetorical. We always knew that one of the weaknesses of the three-word phrase defund the police is that it only captured the kind of negative aspects of the argument as if it were sort of a punishment of police, rather than the positive aspects of the argument, which were to take those resources that we spend on policing and put them into community-based safety strategies to create flourishing neighborhoods. We need to go back to that original concept of divest from the criminal legal system, invest in communities. When we do that and we have a chance to explain it to people, there's actually very high levels of support for that. Things like getting police out of schools and bringing in counselors and after-school programs, creating community-based mental health crisis response teams instead of sending police. It turns out that hundreds of cities are actually investing in these alternatives to policing, but what they're not doing is actually dialing back policing.
Do you have a three-word slogan that would convey this idea better?
No, I mean, and that was part of the problem, that I was involved in conversations that summer of 2020 with folks in the movement, very bright people, trying to figure out something that would fit, you know, in one line of a Twitter post with a hashtag, because if it was, or would fit on a cardboard sign, because anything longer than that won't get picked up in the same way. And we haven't really succeeded in that.
Okay, so some clever ad person really needs to come up with something. Okay, what about bail reform and decarceration strategies that have been experimented with around the country?
Well, that's sort of what I was alluding to earlier with the progressive prosecution strategy, which is that it's a from within the legal system approach that imagines that the end goal is merely to reduce the number of incarcerated people. And my point of view about this is that the end goal has to be to create healthier, safer, more just communities. And decarceration through things like bail reform and decriminalization by themselves don't do that. We still have a mass homelessness problem. We still have a mass economic precarity problem. We still have mass untreated mental health and substance abuse problems. And just removing people from the criminal legal system doesn't address those vulnerabilities and insecurities and leaves us vulnerable to community backlash, which is exactly what has happened.
I just got a bulletin from the New York Post before I sat down to do this interview. The Post is practically a PR arm of the New York Police Department. But the bulletin said that the cops are applauding Trump's appointment of Tom Homan as border czar. He's tough. He will crack down on the migrants and all the crime they cause. What's going on here? The nature of these migrant problems that we hear so much about coming from the right and the Democrats guiltily admitting to some degree. What's the story here? Is there a crime wave because of migrants?
No. There's huge amounts of evidence historically that show that recent arrivals are actually much less likely to engage in crime than those who were born here, who are citizens. Now, there is some disorder, some instability, and some crime that attaches to a new population, but it has been blown completely out of proportion because it has been folded into a political strategy. So a crime committed by a migrant becomes front page news, while the same crime committed by someone born here is not covered. And so this skews people's perceptions of the level of threat, which, of course, plays into the hands of all the anti-immigrant rhetoric generated by the right and then leaned into by the Democrats.
Okay, let's anticipate some what the Trump administration might look like in the areas of crime and punishment. Trump has made a big deal out of deportations. He seems to think he can deport 11 million people, which is just frightening to think of in its brutality, but also its impracticality is also hard to comprehend. What do you think of this? What's going to come of that? Is he serious? Could it be done? How would it be done? What would the results be?
Well, I think, you know, we should remember that when Trump was president before, his ability to build a wall, to make all these changes was extremely limited. His governing capacity is low, and it's important to keep in mind that Trump's primary interest is his own personal self-promotion, running his confidence games and building up his own personal brand and real estate values and all the rest. So actually achieving the stuff in, you know, the 2025 plan, in what was on the campaign agenda, is limited. However, there is a lot of political cover for moving forward on this. There is a lot of expectation that something be done. And so I think we will see a significant ramping up of deportations. I think they'll be organized around punishing cities that didn't support him, punishing industries that didn't support him by targeting their workforces. And I think that this could be extremely disruptive in many parts of the country. Now, the capacity to quickly deport millions of people, you're absolutely right, it's not there. But we will see sustained efforts to enhance that capacity. And that's going to mean dramatic expansions of immigrant detention facilities. And while it takes time to build new ones, they have always relied on capacity of local jails as a secondary place to hold people pending deportation. And so I think we'll see a lot of local jail space converted to migrant detention facilities. And we might even see the use of more informal migrant camps where people will be held in conditions, you know, similar to what we saw with Japanese internment camps during World War II.
Yeah, he's been talking about tent cities for both migrants and for the homeless as well. This is basically concentration camps.
Yes, I mean, there will, of course, be legal challenges which may find a sympathetic ear at the local and state level, but that, of course, the Supreme Court, I think, cannot be counted upon to uphold any kind of constitutional rights at a national level. But those other challenges could significantly slow down those efforts.
Who would do it? ICE, local police forces? What?
All of the above. We already have a history of the federal government incentivizing local sheriffs to become border police. But I think now we'll see something more like what we've had experimented with in places like Arizona, where basically all law enforcement are pressured to become ICE agents and to really go out of their way to first transfer folks who have been arrested and accused of a crime, but also just in their daily interactions with the public, rounding people up.
I'm speaking with the sociologist Alex Vitale. What will they do with jurisdictions, New York City, Los Angeles, San Francisco, that are not particularly welcoming this sort of crackdown? How will they handle that?
Well, they're already in a place like New York, while they don't get quite the level of formal cooperation from the jail and the police, they just station themselves outside the courthouse. And as people are released on at arraignment or in other conditions, then they're just picked up by ICE or sometimes in the courtroom. So they have ways around this. Also, they have the right to operate in these cities with or without local cooperation. So we could see targeted home raids, business raids, neighborhood raids that are carried out exclusively by federal law enforcement.
Is there a way to resist this stuff other than litigation?
Yes. Well, I think if we remember the first Trump presidency, one of the really dramatic responses to some of the anti-immigrant, like travel bans and things like that, were the direct actions at airports around the country. This was very dramatic and very destabilizing. And I think it had a big impact. And I think that it's going to take those kinds of disruptive protests to carve out some space, because Congress is not going to save us. The courts are not going to save us. And we could also look at there are a lot of groups around the country that already engage in some deportation defense work that looks a little bit like eviction defense has looked historically, which is phone trees get activated, people come out and try to actively interfere with roundups.
Yeah, it's funny. People talk about, liberals talk about Trump as a fascist, yet their idea of resisting him is, I'm going to move from Twitter to Blue Sky, or I'm going to file a lawsuit, or I'm going to make a friendship bracelet. I think we need something more aggressive if you really think this guy is a fascist.
Well, this is, of course, the fundamental flaw with the liberal analysis, which is steadfast in its fantastical commitment to the myth of the rule of law, that somehow that rule of law, when properly activated, automatically benefits everyone equally, and that when there's a threat to that rule of law, the solution is to double down on our reliance on it. And it's almost impossible for them to imagine a politics that isn't rooted in the electoral and legal processes.
Before I press the record button, we were talking about Trump's idea of repurposing the Department of Justice. What did you have in mind with that?
Well, I think it's really we're going to see this unwinding of the narrative around reforming the criminal justice system. You know, there's a huge industry of monitors and consultants and people making proposals, hoping that somehow the federal government through the Department of Justice is going to carry out oversight of police, reform prison abuses, etc. It's clear that the Trump Justice Department will have no interest in any of this, that police and prison administrators will be given a free hand to do as they want with the backing of the courts. And so it really calls into question why we would invest a single dime in the typical kinds of reform strategies that are rooted either in litigation or in hoping that the Department of Justice will somehow come and save us. The alternative to that is to double down on local organizing that demands community-level investments to create truly safe, just communities, which means dialing back our reliance on policing and criminalization.
It also seems like Trump may use the Justice Department to pursue his personal vendettas. What do you think of the risk of that?
We'll see both his own personal vendettas, but I think more broadly, we will see attacks on the left, especially if we have the kind of direct action kind of resistance, or we show success at the local level in putting in place some of these alternatives that I've outlined. And so I think we should be very wary of the rolling out of increased surveillance and harassment. But I do think that the feds are going to have their hands full, on a lot of fronts, and I don't think that we should organize our movements around the possibility of federal surveillance. I think we should be open about our actions, and we should strive towards mass organizing.
Why do you think they're going to have their hands full? What will they be distracted by?
Well, I think just carrying out the deportation regime, trying to dial back the kinds of things that the Biden administration put in place, also dreaming up more ways to dismantle historic kinds of civil rights initiatives. Also, I think they're going to be put to task on the reproductive rights front in trying to further criminalize people's access to reproductive options.
Now, we're all being rational empiricists here, but that's not how American politics work. How do we fight back against these crime panics in a more productive way?
Well, I think that we need a politics that isn't rooted in every 4 years we spend $1 billion on get out the vote efforts, mostly through mass media. We need to engage in base building, which means financing community-based organizing around local issues that serves the function of enhancing local political education through direct experience and through exposure to ideas and the rest. I mean, we saw in the election results that Trump voters believed in a whole range of things that were just patently untrue. And the reason is in part because the only way they get information about how the world works is by watching right-wing national news. And we need to engage as many of those people at the community level around the problems that they actually confront in their everyday lives and give them a different analysis about how to address it.
A friend posted on Twitter the other day that she noticed that the cops were harassing her in the subway, the New York cops, and was wondering if the cops now feel some kind of license to be even more brutal than they would be otherwise because of Trump. Do you think that's going to be an issue?
Over the last 10 years, policing has really experienced this legitimacy crisis because of the level of police killings and the resistance to them. And the response to this is always a discourse around community policing and community relations and trying to be more responsive and de-escalating conflict. And I think that the Trump election signals a kind of broad rejection of that approach and the unwillingness of the federal government to play any role in supporting it. And I think that this will embolden individual police and many police departments to quit pretending around the officer-friendly thing. The only limit to this is the fact that ultimately policing is a local matter that's accountable to local political elites. And so this may mean that in some of the big cities controlled by more progressive mayors, that that level of aggressiveness will be in some degree of check. But of course, here in New York City, we have a police mayor who has already signaled his support for complete police impunity. And so we shouldn't be surprised by an increase of abusive policing.
Civilian control of the military is an amazing political accomplishment, but we can't seem to achieve civilian control of the police. What's holding that back?
Well, I agree completely. It is an amazing achievement with the military, and it will, of course, come under some strain under a Trump presidency, and I only hope it will hold. I think part of the problem here is that policing is such a local matter. We have 19,000 police departments, and the vast majority of them are for fairly small towns and jurisdictions. And I think they're caught up in a real right-wing culture, and that they're not subjected to the same kind of drumbeat about being under civilian leadership, and that esprit de corps just never really gets communicated in the same way. And most of these local politicians are essentially very happy to have the police running wild and acting in the ways that they do. So they're not actually interested in asserting that much civilian control.
Another story the Post loves, besides every crime a migrant commits, is the discontent of the NYPD. They're losing officers. A lot of more officers want to leave. What do we make of this?
Well, this is a routine narrative, and it always ramps up right around the period of contract negotiations so that it can be used to try to gin up support for more salaries, less regulation of working behavior and all the rest. So I don't put much stock in this. To the extent that we have attrition in policing, this is a great opportunity to redirect resources in a new direction. And if we listen carefully to what the police claim they're discontented about, I think that's just gives us more fodder for why we shouldn't be using them in the first place.
And, you know, a couple of years ago, 3-4 years ago, we had this great movement about getting control over the police, reining them back. And now that seems all gone, and if anything, worse than before. What happened, and how can we revive it?
Actually, the sort of post-George Floyd movement that was more rooted in an abolitionist analysis was not a big proponent of community control of the police and was not very focused on the conventional accountability measures that have come out of the police reform movement. There was within that movement already a deep skepticism. Basically, the impunity of policing is a feature, not a bug. You cannot have policing that is accountable because then it cannot carry out its core missions in the way it has been designed to do so. It is a waste of time, basically, to invest our energies in these accountability measures instead of getting the police out of our lives in as many ways as we possibly can.
That's Alex Vitale, professor of sociology at Brooklyn College, and author of The End of Policing from Verso. That's it for me, Doug Henwin. Let's go at this. Another chestnut, Police on My Back, by The Clash. Till next week, bye.